students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have Edgar High School. Those students please stand. Glad to see you also. You may be seated. And we have Watertown High School students with us. We're delighted to see you all, too. These students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come to oral argument. They're sent briefs of the cases if they accept the invitation. The classroom might engage in a number of activities about this case. And then students will meet with a justice of this court after this case, and they might be joined by students who were here earlier this morning. There are synopses of the case available in the outside corridor, and we think it's so if you don't have a synopsis of the case and want one, you may raise your hand and the marshal will get it for you, or you may leave the courtroom and pick one up outside. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. And it's Justice Prosser who will meet with you after this oral argument. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Now, when Justice Prosser meets with you all, he will discuss with you the processes that the court uses in hearing and deciding cases. The substantive law of this case will not be discussed. All of you are welcome to attend that session, even if you're not part of the student group. With those introductions made, I'm now going to call our second case for today, 03-1877, In Re, the Paternity of John R.B., Barbara R. versus Dorian H. Arguing on behalf of Dorian H. is Renee E. Mura. Ms. Mura?
May it please the court, I am Renee Mura and I represent Dorian Harper in this case. The issue that the court must decide is whether Wisconsin Statute 767.32 is unconstitutional and that it forbids retroactive modification of child support arrearages, including principal and interest. As a brief synopsis for the court, I will very briefly go over the facts, the number of changes of law, a new statute of limitations that is now in effect, and I will discuss the balancing test for constitutionality, and then finally discuss the interest payments on child support and how they differ from the payment that was originally to be made. The facts in this case, as you know, is that a child was born in 1979. This was a paternity action where judgment was granted in 1982. Thus, that began the statute of limitations running. In 1983, there was an oral contract entered into between the father and the mother, whereby the father would pay the child's private schooling education at Armitage Academy for grades 1 through 6. The father complied with the terms of that agreement. In addition, there was an agreement made between these parties that the father would no longer visit the child if he did not have to pay child support. The father abided by that agreement. In 1993, the statute was modified, basically taking away equitable remedies for payers of child support and looking at like payments that they could have made in lieu of child support. Again, in 1997, after Dorian H.'s obligation for child support expired, another law was enacted, giving certain exceptions whereby the court could look at certain payments made as long as they conformed with the plain language of the statute. In 2001, the mother petitioned the court on an order to show cause seeking payment of retroactive child support and accumulated interest therein. The initial court who decided this issue stated that this was a case that the arrearages and child support orders should have been zeroed out, that it was not equitable to Dorian, and that the mother waited too long to bring this action. That was subsequently overturned by the circuit court, Judge Kluka, and the Court of Appeals that upheld that decision. There have been a number of changes of law that impact this case. The first law is in 1993, which basically closed equitable remedies available to Mr. Harper that this court recognized were available in 1990. Further, the legislation that was enacted in 1997, I believe, was specifically addressing the problems that were inherent with closing off all equitable remedies, recognizing that parents were paying their child support obligations, but not maybe directly to the clerk of circuit court, and thus should get credit for that. So the statute then gave some exceptions, recognizing that there was a problem here.
Counselor, do you have some number for us of the amount of child support that he paid during the time his son was in grades 1 through 6?
What I do have through the testimony is that he did pay the private school education, which was somewhere between the figure of $800 and $1,500 per year. Those records were not able to be attained at the time that this litigation brought, which is one of the problems for people in the situation of Dorian, is that now bringing their records forward to show exactly what the amount of payments were.
Okay, so the answer is no, you don't know exactly what.
Not exactly.
Okay, and after the child got out of sixth grade, he made no further child support payments, either directly or indirectly, correct?
That is correct. However, what the court should know in this case is that Dorian was paying on another child through the child support system, and a payment when this child was 10 years old was directed to...
I understand that, and I know you're going to tell me that there was an agreement between the parents that he wouldn't see the child if he didn't have to make any child support payments. And while the mother may have wanted him out of the child's life, I'm not altogether sure that having him out of the child's life was good for the child. Why should we even consider such an agreement? Why shouldn't we just say it's void and against public policy and he gets no benefit from it?
Because I don't believe that it is against public policy, because people should be able to decide what is best for their own child. And I will give you an example. Many times people come to court, they don't want a particular parent involved in the child's life, maybe because they have alcohol problems, drug problems, because the transfer of the child back and forth is causing too much stress on the child, or perhaps a third party is standing instead of the birth parent and providing that stability and that either father figure or mother figure to the child that is most beneficial instead of having the parent visit. This is something that the two parties themselves can decide, which actually courts many, many times decide to stop visitation because it's in the best interest of the child when you bring that to litigate, or they could order supervised visitation. And why do we say that parents themselves cannot agree what is best in their particular situation for their children? And I think that is the crux of the issue here. Furthermore, people do this.
If his contact with the child was harmful to the child, that's a separate issue from whether or not he ought to have been paying money to support that child. And the statute is there because so many children do not have the clothes they need, the shoes they need, the food they need, because dads take a powder on paying, and they don't care if they see the child or not.
Okay,
and maybe the moms would like them to be gone too, but it doesn't help the child much.
But let's look at the law here and what it does. It doesn't protect... What this law does is it doesn't change anything for those people who are evading the court system, who never show up in court, who's the recipient of the child support, is bringing actions before the court to collect child support. These are cases that are affecting those people who are acting in good faith, paying their child support, maybe in some other form than paying through the trust system or directly to the parent a check for child support but may be paying for something like private school education.
I agree that that's an equitable circumstance. My biggest concern here is no support, not a dollar, no support for no visitation. I have real problems with that.
Counsel?
Except,
go ahead.
May I answer that?
Yeah, of course.
The court does that all the time.
When?
Because people can go to court right now today, enter an order terminating their child support obligation, both sign on the dotted line. The court never questions that. Absolutely. It is done.
I have never seen that. How could you say that's in the best interest of the child not to have any support paid?
But you're assuming that the child is not being supported and that the support that he needs and desires is from the parent, either the mother or the father. And if that was the situation, what you are really looking at is an enforcement issue for those children that need child support, which I believe is completely overlooked by the legislation. Our legislature has tried to make this law so narrow and state that we can't look at equitable remedies, we cannot modify past child support arrearages, basically for any reason as of 1993, and then subsequently open the door a little bit in 1997. But that doesn't affect the enforcement problem for those people who are going to court and asking the court to intervene because they are not getting child support and they need child support. This legislation doesn't affect the Dorian H's out there who are ones who are readily available. They're not shirking. They're not evading the court system. They can be served at any time, just as in this case, Mr. H, was able to be served. His whereabouts were known all the time, and at any time, the mother could have petitioned the court for an order to commence that child support.
Counsel, can I just ask this question? In this case and in many other cases, you're in the court system. We're being asked to look at an oral agreement. We're being asked to, in which the parties themselves have conflicting fact scenarios. How in the world, and you say that this is good and this should be enforced by this court, but how in the world could the court system handle a situation where there are or encourage a situation where there are oral agreements, which in themselves are, you know, we have to look at the circumstances and then take A's word over B and what happened. It just seems to fly in the face of good sense and reasonable conduct that this court would accept oral agreements and then put the face of enforceability on those oral agreements. Tell me why you think that that should be.
Well, I think that especially in family law cases, when family courts deal with placement issues, there are oral agreements all the time entered into these types of litigants. Why? They're in close proximity. They talk with each other. And the court can make a finding, just as Commissioner Fitzgerald did in this case upon hearing the evidence, much like they do in any other contract case involving an oral agreement. You look at the conduct of the parties. You look what has transpired. You look to see if there was a quid pro quo or some consideration offered. And you look at what has happened. And I believe that that is not difficult for the court to determine once you present the facts, and each side will present the facts. They are the triers of a fact, the circuit court, and they can come to those decisions just as they do in deciding placement issues when parents have modified their placement agreements and now the child is doing a shared placement instead of what once used to be a primary secondary. The court can see that there was an oral agreement to share placement if that child was, in fact, at the other parent's house 50% of the time.
Mira, can I interrupt for a minute?
Yes.
My understanding is that you're arguing that the statutory scheme is unconstitutional. Let me ask you this. Aren't a lot of the changes that came about in 1993 a result of federal requirements and the Federal Family Support Act?
That is correct. That is why this harsh legislation came down, because of the federal mandate. Exactly. But the federal mandate was to get people who were not paying child support to pay their child support. This law doesn't protect those people who are not being paid child support.
Well, have other states enacted similar legislation?
I do not know that.
Have any other states that you're aware of found legislation akin to this unconstitutional?
I do not know that.
Ms. Mayor, if I could follow up just for a moment on Justice Rogan-Sack's question. It seems what we have here is an agreement by two parents to, in effect, do a self-help termination of parental rights in exchange for not paying child support. Is that, and if it is, how is it consistent with good public policy to enforce that type of an agreement?
Well, first of all, I would tell you that a court would not terminate parental rights for a child unless there was either an adoptive resource for that child or a step-parent coming in to adopt that child.
I realize the court wouldn't, but isn't that the effect of this agreement, that the agreement says that if you do not, if you go away and you pay the tuition for a period of time and you go away, I'm not going to ask for any money for child support. Now, that's what the crux of the agreement was, right?
That is true. However, the child will still get the benefits if Dorian would pass away, inheritance rights, maybe rights to Social Security, other benefits that are attributable due to that lineage of parent and child that would not be available if this was a termination of parental rights case.
Sorry, did you finish?
I finished.
Okay. Your argument, to me, sounds in right to contract, and you talk about the parties are able to contract, the parents are able to contract, and the right to contract. The problem I have, and I need you to address it, is that you're only talking about two parties in interest, the father and the mother. What about the child's rights with regard to this bilateral contract? And what about the state's rights? I, as a taxpayer, way too often see children that the state has to support because the parents aren't adequately supporting. So the state also has an interest, I think. And yet you're suggesting that a bilateral contract is the sole focus. What about those other two interested parties, the child's interest to have a father in his life?
Well, again, I would focus on what the parties themselves agree is in the best interest of the child.
How many parties are you talking about? Two?
Parents, yeah. Yes.
Okay. But see, my underlying premise in my question is that there are more parties in interest than just the two.
Well, the child's interests hopefully are being represented by the decisions made by the parents. The only other way that the children's interests are represented is through the guardian ad litem, and they do not get involved in the financial matters of children. You had asked me about the state and taxpayers taking the responsibility for these cases where children are not being supported. Again, that would not fall into our category of cases in the case involving Dorian H., because if the state was asked to pay benefits to a parent for support, they would, by law, they are mandated to go after the payer. Again, we're looking at an enforcement issue where finding the deadbeat parents who are not paying, not making this legislation such that the ramifications result in manifest injustice where the parties may have agreed that it's more beneficial that I pay for the private school education, whatever that may be, and not pay the $30 weekly into the trust system. Or maybe when the child is in high school, it's more important for that child to have a vehicle, and the parent agrees to purchase the vehicle in that last year instead of paying the child support because it's more beneficial to the child, a big lump sum payment that maybe a parent can come up with, could not come up with, and then the child can drive himself to his activities or things like that. Or what about if you have an exceptionally talented child that needs to spend $10,000 on a violin, and that is something that a parent wants. I want the violin. That's more important for our child. I can do the other payments and support our child.
But what about what we used to see before 93, oftentimes in the context of paternities? Maybe a 17-year-old mother with a 21-year-old father, and there were these paternity settlements. I'll admit paternity, and I'll give you a lump sum payment. You know, and here's the 17-year-old who now has a child and needs an apartment and has no transportation. So for a lump sum payment of, you pick a figure, $8,000, $6,000, enough to get her an apartment and to get her set up and to get some kind of a clunker car for transportation. That was the agreement between the parties, and that there no further child support would ever have to be paid. I mean, you're giving violin examples, but the kind of example I'm giving is the kind that I used to see as a circuit court judge. Those kinds of agreements between the parties. Yet doesn't your argument encompass those things, too?
I think so, and I absolutely. And what I wanted to state is that with the enactment of that new statute of limitations, you see how this problem is even greater than it existed under the old law for statute of limitations, because now a party has 39 years in which to sue, with the current law stating you can never look back, never give any equitable remedies. If in fact there was this agreement, you put up the child in an apartment, you paid for these certain things in lieu of not paying child support, why should that parent not get credit for that? How is that fundamentally fair that 20 years after the child reaches the age of majority, you can go back and sue a parent unbeknownst to them, and there's going to be lots of these cases unbeknownst to them, that now they don't have the documentation to prove that they made these payments, so they don't have a written agreement, because the reality of the situation is a lot of people in family court don't write down things. Their actions speak louder than their words, so to speak.
Counselor, if we accept your notion that the parties can make an agreement, the father will have no contact with the child if the mother says no child support, don't we put mothers in the position of being intimidated by fathers who may wish to bully them into accepting no payments, fathers that maybe they don't particularly want to deal with? These parties never did get married, so obviously they didn't have a lasting relationship here. Aren't we really putting mothers and children at the disadvantage of those former partners who may be much stronger than they are?
No, I think that what you will find is that fathers or mothers, whoever is the payer parent, and they would, well, let me rephrase that. I think, as in this situation, you had a real motivation on the part of the mother in not wanting the father to visit. And as the court commissioner found that she believed that if she brought him back to court for child support, that he would then invoke his rights to visitation. Why does the commissioner know that? Because that happens all the time. A pleading is filed and you get a counter petition or a counter order to show cause.
Right.
And again, on the public policy issue, who is best to decide those issues? And why should Dorian, at this point, when he has given up his relationship with his child, there are no remedies. He has fulfilled his part of the bargain, and now this parent can come back.
Where's the remedy for the little boy that's grown up and now is a man at 22 years old and has never had a father? Where's his remedy?
Where was his remedy at the time that he was a minor? All the mother had to do was to file an order to show cause to commence child support payments again. She did not do that.
No, maybe she was afraid of the father.
But a trial court would be able to determine that in deciding the equities and the rationale agreement.
We had a judgment of a court of competent jurisdiction that said he was to pay $30 a week support. He didn't comply with that order, right? And you're saying we ought to honor that noncompliance because the mom acceded to it by saying, okay, you don't pay me support and you don't get visitation. Well, I understand all of that, but I still don't see where the child's interest in having a parent come into play at all.
That's not going to be resolved by finding this legislation constitutional. It's just going to further the inequities to one party in the case, the payor, because now the payee can still do the no child support, no visitation. Child loses out, and 20 years after the child reaches the age of majority, because the parent now needs some money for some unknown reason, says, you know what, that law allows me to sue, and I'm going to sue, and I'm going to get this large amount of child support.
Isn't he still in exactly the same position he was in before? He now owes $30 a week. The only difference is he owes a heck of a lot of interest. But as far as the principal payments, he's in the same position he was in before. Nothing's changed.
He's not really in the same position because in this case, he paid his child support, and then he paid the private school education. And the law says that he cannot get credit for any of that private school education.
Right, but that was a very limited period of time from grades 1 through 6. That was a very limited period of time. In regard to the rest of the time, he doesn't have anything to balance against the amount that's owed, except that if you can say he sold his right to be a father for $30 a week. That's what we're supposed to uphold here?
But both the payer and the payee entered into that agreement. Why would we hold one to the law and not the other? It's unfair.
Counsel, let me ask regarding that point. Assume for sake of this question only that we were not to agree with your position regarding public policy, that we think that this type of an agreement is bad public policy. Starting with that assumption, and given the fact that these parties lived with this agreement for 18-plus years, what would you have us do with this case now? How would you have us decide this matter?
I just want to address first your comment that this is bad public policy.
I'm not saying it is. I'm saying assume for purposes of this question that we find that it's bad public policy. Take me to the next step. Where would you have us go?
I would have you state that the statute as to retroactive modification of a child support arrearage and accumulated interest is unconstitutional. That, in other words, you should be able to allow modification using the principles of equity, equitable estoppel, latches, some equitable remedies to these parties with the court making findings. That is what I see as the remedy.
So you're asking,
retrospective application.
So basically what you're saying is that this court should rule unconstitutional, should reject the notion that the legislature passed regarding our equitable remedies. Is that a separation of powers issue?
I don't believe it's a separation of powers issue. I believe that it is a due process issue in weighing the public interest versus the private interest. And the private interest in finding the statute unconstitutional and allowing equitable remedies far surpasses the public interest. What I saw as the public interest in this case is providing child support to a child, and we've addressed that somewhat now. And I tell you that this law doesn't do that. Child support can be given in another form and now pays unjust enriched because they don't get credit for their payment. There's no incentive to go back to court when the child is a minor and needs that child support. They can wait and get the benefit of these large amounts of interest. Children aren't getting their support, and the statute isn't doing it because it's not a legislative problem. It's an enforcement problem that requires a payee to go to court when they're not getting child support and catching the deadbeat parents, not the ones that they know where they are and they've entered into these agreements with. The statute doesn't help because it encourages payees to wait to get a windfall. The other public interest that I saw in this case is imposing an evidentiary requirement. 3, conserving judicial and state resources, which I don't believe is compelling because Family courts hear these issues all the time, and under sub 1R on that 1997 statute, the court still has to make findings and hear evidence under that new law, under the exceptions that have been enumerated. Another public interest is easily calculating a child support arrearages, but that's insignificant. That's a bookkeeping function. And finally, the interests of justice. And I see that the interests of justice are not met by the statute because it's requiring the courts to close their eyes to the reality of situations and how people with their children function. And they're not running to court. They aren't hiring attorneys. They don't want to do that. They believe that their oral agreements are binding. And if they could prove that in court, a court using equitable principles should be able to find that. What I see as the substantial private interests that are being usurped in this case is, number one, the ability of parents to contract with each other, because I believe that those parents can best decide what is in the best interests of their child, and their agreements should be binding. And this argument, well, the child is suffering. Well, the child is suffering if the parent waits until the child is age of majority and then brings an action. So we don't resolve that problem that was raised in this case. Second of all, the ability of parties to determine how child support should be paid. Maybe they see the benefit of paying for the child private school education or paying for some extracurricular activities that are more expensive than maybe other ways, or the purchase of a car, things such as that. Or, as I indicated, it would be probably a different case, but, you know, a purchase of an instrument or sporting equipment or something like that if a child is gifted in the area. The financial burden on an unknowing party with child support arrears and interest, the financial burden in this case, how will Dorian H. ever be able to pay this insurmountable child support order with interest that accrued on him unbeknownst to him because of the delay in bringing this case to court? There is no ability for him to mitigate his damages, and his ability to right a wrong and defend himself in court is not available, which I believe is a substantial due process issue in this case. And so I believe...
Counsel.
I'm sorry.
Do you think you've answered Justice Butler's question?
Yes.
All right. Counsel, while you do have several minutes in rebuttal, I want you to consider the application of the statute of frauds, 241.021a. This was not in writing, correct?
Right.
All right. Thank you. We'll next hear from Barbara Beardsley. Ms. Beardsley?
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court. Good morning. I am here representing myself and my son, John. I'm a nurse, not an attorney, and I will not pretend to have extensive knowledge of the law. However, I do know what is right and just. It is right and just for parents to support their children. 25 years ago yesterday was the most joyful day of my life. I was blessed with the birth of our beautiful son, John. Since that day, I have loved him, cared for him, and supported him. Unfortunately, not everyone loves or cares for their child. This lack of care or concern for their child does not negate the parents' obligations. I'm here today because for the past 25 years, Mr. H. has not fulfilled his obligation to our son. My argument was detailed in the brief submitted to this court, and I will not reiterate it in full here. However, I would just like to review a few key points. In June of 2002, Judge Kluka found that Mr. H. owed the child support arrears and interest. In December of 2003, the appeals court affirmed her decision. They held that Wisconsin Statute 76732 properly balances the public interest in requiring parents to provide for the support of their child, and that compliance was in the control of the payer. They also found that 767 was constitutional. Mr. H. had both a forum and a procedure by which to address his concerns. Although it is important to consider these rights, it is imperative that the court require proof of any extrajudicial agreement. Failure to do this could result in manifest inequity to thousands of children and custodial parents. To allow any parent ordered to pay support to have their obligation expunged by claiming to have an agreement excusing them with no proof could be devastating.
Could I ask a question about the facts?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Whatever, is there more than one child involved?
Not with me. Mr. H has other children.
Other children.
Mm-hmm.
During the period that your son John has been alive, have you received payments from the county or the state?
Just when I right after he was born, I worked up until the time of his birth, but because I had a cesarean section, I couldn't go back to work for 3 months, and so I did receive a limited amount of aid.
Now, there was an agreement in 1982 that $30 a week was to be paid?
Yes, sir.
But it wasn't paid?
It was paid for a brief period of time until Mr. H moved out of state.
And when the payment stopped, what did you do?
I didn't do anything at the time.
Is it important to know why you didn't do anything?
Well, I knew that Mr. H was aware of his obligations, and I had had dealings with him before through the courts in establishing paternity, which was about a 2-year battle. I guess at the time maybe my emotions were a little raw yet. As you can see, this action has been a 3.5-year battle to try and reinstate the support order. So I think that perhaps you can understand my reluctance to have dealings through the court with him again.
Does the state or the county have any claim for money paid to you from him?
No, sir.
So the only claim is money owed to you on behalf of your son, John?
Yes.
You may proceed. Okay.
This is the shortest statement ever, I'm sure you've heard. I respectfully ask the court to consider these issues and do the following. Uphold the decision of the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals that Mr. H owes the child support arrears and interest. Find that the retroactive application of Wisconsin Statute 767.32 is constitutional, and affirm that equitable remedies are available, but only in prescribed circumstances and with clear and convincing evidence, and which do not violate the public interest.
I think. I just have one question. On the, I talked to opposing counsel on the oral agreement, and I take it that that's what it was. There was simply an oral agreement dealing with the first 6 years of your son's schooling. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, that's been one of my difficulties in this entire case, because the original judgment was based on the assumption that there was an oral agreement. There was never any oral agreement between us as respect to no payment of support and no visitation. The only agreement that we had was when I had requested that he assist with private school tuition, which actually was halfway through John's second grade year, and he did pay part of that tuition from third grade through sixth grade. But that was the only agreement we ever had with regard to finances.
The agreement then was, according to you, was not to waive, not to forgive the $30 a week.
No, ma'am. I never had that intent.
This agreement, you say, was made before judgment or after judgment?
After.
What was the reason behind his stopping payments and stopping visitation. Did you tell him not to, that he couldn't visit if he didn't make payments? Was there anything like that that occurred?
No, ma'am. He moved out of the state, and we did maintain contact after he moved out of the state. There were telephone calls. There were occasional Christmas gifts sent. He did come up and visit and attend my son's first communion ceremony and party when he was 7. And that was the last physical contact that they had, unfortunately.
So you weren't trying to keep him out of your son's life?
No, ma'am. I would have welcomed him being a part of my son's life, as any mother would. I feel terrible for my son that he never had a father all those years.
Your son went to Armitage Academy for 6 years?
No, he started there. Pardon me. He was attending our a Catholic school for first grade and half of second grade. And halfway through second grade, I enrolled him in Armitage. And I had attempted to try to pay. I was working. I had to work at the school to work off part of the tuition, although John did get some scholarship money from the school. But it was just getting to be too much for me, and that's why I had called Mr. H and asked him to help out.
So you made in-kind payments to the school through your work, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Did you pay any money to the school?
I believe I did at the first year of his attendance.
Do you know what the tuition was at the school?
I believe the tuition was around $1,500, but my son had a half scholarship for the tuition, so the balance would have been around $750 a year, I believe, at that time.
Okay. Did he stop making child support payments before John was at Armitage?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you acquiesced in that and didn't take him back to court again, but then when the bills got big, you called him and asked him, would he at least help with that?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Do you have any sense of how much he paid toward Armitage School?
Well, as I said, it would the tuition was $750 a year. That would have been third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. But I know he didn't pay the entire amount because the school was calling me trying to collect tuition that he had not fulfilled, made the payments for. And so I referred them to contact him because he had agreed to do that. So I don't know an exact amount.
Was any sum taken off for his payments that he owes you? Any sum taken off?
No.
Okay. Are there any further questions?
Let me ask
Justice Price
once more. This gentleman owed you $30 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early years after 1982, I can understand why there would have been a lot of tension and hard feelings and mixed emotions. But why didn't you do anything, say, in 1992?
To be honest, that was probably my mistake, but in not taking the action sooner. But at the time, as I said, I went through a two-odd-year battle for paternity settlement with this gentleman. I've been through a three-and-a-half-year battle at this point in life over this child support. And at that time in my life, I was working full-time, going to school full-time, raising our child. I just didn't have the wherewithal to go through this type of battle at that point in my life.
Counsel, I do have one question. I don't recall where I saw it, but is it factually correct that, and I forget the exact year, that's what I was looking for, that you had asked Dorian H. For some money to help with the child's college, and when he indicated that he could not or was not able to do so, that's when you filed a petition with the court?
That is correct. I had called him and asked him to help our son out. He was in college at the time, was struggling, and had asked him if he could possibly send him a few $100 to help him out. And at that point in time, his response to me was, I've already done enough, and I can't do that, and proceeded to go on and tell me about his foster children that he was taking in. So it was at that point in time that I had called the child support agency, and they had advised me that it was possible to file an order to reinstate this support order.
Any further questions? Hearing none, thank you, Ms. Beardsley. Unless you have something else to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Counsel? Ms. Muir?
Justice Abrahamson, if I may ask you to please restate your question that you had for me on the statute of frauds issue.
241.02 says, in the following case, every agreement shall be void unless the agreement or some note or memorandum thereof expressing the consideration be in writing and subscribed by the party charged therewith. A, every agreement by that by its terms is not to be performed within 1 year from the making. And it's my understanding this was an agreement not to be performed with 1 year, and that there's nothing in writing. Now, maybe it falls under some other exception to the statute of fraud, and I'm just asking, had you considered that?
I had not considered that. I don't believe that this type of agreement would have to be in writing pursuant to the mandate of 241.02. Also, I see
an exception in 241.02 that subsection 1 doesn't apply to marital property agreements, but there's no exception for support agreements. I'm merely bringing that to your attention.
Okay.
Is there a statute of limitations problem at all here?
I believe there is a significant, maybe in what context are you referring to?
Well, you tell me.
Okay. I believe that there is a significant statute of limitations problem in this case, in that, as I indicated, the new law expands the time in which to sue for past due child support to now 39 years, when initially the law and this court found that the 20-year statute of limitations would run from the date of judgment, which would be from an order of the court establishing a child support order or judgment of paternity when a specific person was found to be the father of the child. The statute of limitations would begin to accrue at that time, and that statute would basically be during the child's life. Now, what has happened is the statute of limitations has been changed to state that the 20-year statute for commencing action actually begins to run upon the child becoming the age of majority, which would be 18 or 19 if still pursuing high school. So you can see that the potential for cases is now 39 years in which to bring litigation, and all for the sole purpose of enforcing child support payments on people who have not paid their child support obligations. But you could see that the result is manifest injustice when it is applied to the people who believe that they had valid contracts, the people who did in fact have valid contracts at the time they entered into the agreements, and through the process of time, the laws have changed unbeknownst to them, such that the result would be that a person had equitable remedies available to them at one point up until 1993, and now thereafter they do not. And it comes to an absurd result because, again, we're not talking about children being supported when they're children. And you can still have the problem with no support, visitation, which, as I said, people can go to court and right now and sign an order, and that's not questioned. But that problem is not resolved by the elongation of that statute of limitations.
Counselor, though, aren't you within the old 20-year statute of limitations by this action anyway?
I believe that we are under the old statute of limitations, absolutely, because...
Right, but the action is timely under the old statute of limitations.
Yes, it is, and it was...
as well, so there really isn't a statute of limitations problem that precludes this action.
No, but when you look at the constitutionality of the statute, you have to consider the new law with the new statute of limitations, because now...
Why? If he comes under the old one, it's timely under the old one. Why do we need to consider the new one?
What about all the people that now are going to fall into this new law, because now the statute has stated that from 1984 is when a person can sue up until 39 years thereafter. So it's all those people that between 1984 and 1993 who had these agreements or who paid in-like payments for child support who now have absolutely no remedy before the courts.
Counsel, maybe I can follow up Justice Rogan-Sack's question in a slightly different way because I'm having trouble understanding the concept. Is it your view that in looking at the statute, that if a person was under a statute of limitations that had already expired, that this statute can go back and relate back to that person? Or if the statute of limitations had expired for an individual, and obviously your client doesn't present that individual, but if it had already been expired, that the statute would not relate back to them?
Actually, I believe that the statute of limitations at the time when the party's cause of action accrued would be the appropriate statute of limitations, yes.
Well, but as you stated, when this action was brought, it was within the statute of limitations operative at that time. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that your whole argument on statute of limitations and constitutionality is not for this case, but might apply in some other case.
It might apply to some other cases because of the fact.
But why should we decide that in your case when it's not before the court?
Because this has, you can see the consequences for people with the new law and how they will be affected.
That may be, but you're not under the new law. You're not under the new statute of limitations. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
However,
maybe you'd like to be.
The sub 1M and the 1R apply to all cases now, effective 1993.
Right, but that's not a statute of limitations issue.
That is true.
A substantive issue. Okay.
Any further questions? Thank you. Oh.
Justice Frost.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Just looks quizzical, but has no questions. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mora. Thank you, Ms. Beardsley, for your argument today. And that closes the hearing of 03-1877, In Re the Paternity of John R.B., Barbara B. versus Dorian H. The court is in recess until 1:30 when we'll hear our third case. Justice Prasa will be out shortly to meet with the students. We are in recess.